Hey everyone, it's time for the next episode of Gig Bag Chats. So let me ask you a question. What does Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Saturday morning cartoons, and Hanna-Barbera all have in common? Our next guest will tell us. Professor Mark, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. I'm excited to learn more about you. We've worked together for, on and off for a little while now. But tell the audience what you do, because you do a lot of different things.
Yeah. Well, somebody asked me a while back I think I've got it on an archival, my old website. There's like an archival website where the original interview was. And they said, well, Professor Mark, you do so many things. How do you describe yourself? Animator or script writer, puppet builder, what do you go with? And I say, usually cartoonist is the best description of what I do, because often an animator ends up, as I found out fairly early when I moved to Atlanta and originally from Alabama to try to get into the animation industry, but I found out very early that most animators end up usually animating scripts from other people, and I kind of like to write my own stuff. It's a little more fun, I think, first of all, I just like cartoonists because, people like Charles Schulz and Bill Watterson and so many others like that, they would both write their scripts and, do their own drawings. And that's just really what I like to do because I think it's so much fun. And I was watching an interview, obviously an archival interview with Jerry Jewell, who was the head writer for The Muppet Show. And he said it was just such a wonderful thing to do because he said just any other, the craziest fantasy you can come up with. And there's a team of people standing by waiting to do that. And that's what I love about, I think animation and puppetry, and even to a lesser degree, radio has all of that in common, is that one person can fulfill so many different jobs if that's what you're into. And I'm kind of a jack of all trades or Professor Mark of all trades. And it's just what I enjoy doing, everything from voices and everything. Although, occasionally I'll get a halfway decent budget where I can get some help of like former students, that do some voices. Like I've got Jen Lee, incredibly talented voice performer. As you know, she did the voice of the
Owen Security superhero. She was the wife or mother or something like that. We'll have to
yeah,
play.
Yeah, I don't think she was a mother. She looked like a Mr. V.
Yes,
that was her.
Yes.
She was the sidekick of Mr.
Right,
V.
Right.
Stand back, Mr. V. I'm gonna smash that door in.
Yeah, and she just did a spectacular voice for that. And then I've got just for about a year now, I've been working with another former student, and I think he's probably pretty close to my age. Actually, I've usually, refer to people in that category as returning students, because occasionally I have it's funny, they're students, but they're, pretty much my age. But just good grief, an incredibly talented guy named John Bonnet, who's doing a lot of my backgrounds now, and I think you've seen some of his work as well. So, yeah, whenever I can afford to, I love to use former students to help me out on these projects to sort of speed things along. I mean, it's fun, in animation to do all of these things, but, it's time consuming.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally understand that. Yeah, it just takes a lot to put it all together that, behind the scenes that a lot of people don't realize, especially when it comes to cartooning and animation, I'm sure. Because you have to hand draw all this stuff and, assemble all the elements rather than I just get a camera and, point it at someone.
Well, that's the nice thing about where puppetry comes in, because, as I said, I dabble in a lot of these different things, animation and puppetry. The cool thing about puppetry is that it's very much like animation, but in real time. Yeah. Sort of the advantage between animation and puppetry is obviously cost because of the time issue. But what's kind of cool is that, it might take me a little bit longer to build one puppet. I might, if I was to spend from, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day for probably about 3 days, I could build probably one puppet. and then it's infinitely recyclable. You know, then I can do everything in real time, and that's what's so wonderful about it. But the great thing about, you know, animation, puppetry, stop motion, and like I said, you know, earlier, to a lesser degree, radio, is a big factor I don't hear a lot of people talking about. And it was something that I learned fairly early on, because originally I was a theater major before I saw Roger Rabbit, you know, that fateful year of 1988. And I decided I wanted to, you know, to go into animation. But one of the things that I did learn that was very useful, because an animator is technically, we're referred to as an actor with a pencil. And a theatrical term I very much, you know, try to share with my students, the suspension of disbelief.
Right.
And that's one of the great things about, again, animation, puppetry, stop motion, and so on, is that it's a little bit easier for an audience to accept these crazy scenarios that we're asking them to temporarily believe in. And that's why I enjoy, you know, it's that fantasy aspect of you know, in science fiction, you can do so much in these realms that you can't get away with in traditional live action until fairly recently, you know, thanks to the technology with, you know, Jurassic Park you know, Lord of the Rings and those sort of epic tales that they can do. But, you know, back in the 70s when I was a kid, you know, if they wanted to do something on the scale of Tolkien, obviously they had to do, you know, Ralph Bakshi did his version with rotoscoping. How else are you going to do all those, you know, thousands of guys on horseback in animation? That's the only way you can do it in 1977 or 1978.
Well, it's interesting you touched on it, like the epics of heck, the Marvel movies or Lord of the Rings. I mean, we're starting to blur that line a little bit on live action and animation, you know, because when you see these behind the scenes shots of any of the Marvel or Lord of the Rings movies, it's all green screen, you know? So at what point do we, it'd be interesting to see where that converges and if that, you know, the Oscar of best animation will start to migrate a little bit. I doubt it, but you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it was very important when, you know, the first, I'd say really two of the big people that really sort of segued from the, you know, what I'll refer to as like the analog age of animation into the digital age, so to speak. Was two of the, I'd say probably two of the biggest guys were, you know, Richard Williams for Roger Rabbit, and then Dennis Muren at Industrial Light and Magic, and both of them deservedly got Oscars for their participation in both of those, because, you know, as often tell my animation students at Art Institute and so on, I'll say, you know, you really have to look at a movie like Roger Rabbit because it paved the way. Even if you're not that much into Saturday morning style animation, which may not be a good term for Roger, but even if you're not that much into hand-drawn character animation, Roger paved the way for how all of these other movies are made, you know, Jurassic Park and so on. There was a guy, I hope I don't have his name wrong. I think it was Michael Lantieri or something along those lines. And his, as I understand it, I believe he had the same job on Roger Rabbit that he did on Jurassic Park.
Oh, interesting.
Where if a character, you know, if, like, you know, in Roger, where, you know, if you see Roger sitting in the chair, you're going to have somebody or a device that turns the chair around at the right moment, and they'll add in Roger later. Or if, you know, if he steps in a puddle, in a rain puddle, then something has got to make a splash, because it's that real world. It's those real world elements that really tie in and make the graphics or whatever that are being added later that make them more believable. The more you can have happening in the real world, the more convincing it is for the audience, and the less work it is for the animators.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. So because you've got anytime you've got like real light hitting a real object, it's so much easier.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I know you touched on this a little bit, but how did you get started? So you were a theater major or in the theater world.
Yeah. It's kind of weird. And I talk about this briefly in my book, The Struggling Cartoonist, which is, it's like the first chapter of the sort of the prologue is almost what really happened. And then after that, of course, you know, when I supposedly meet my cartoon characters, that then it just, you know, rockets into the realm of fantasy really quickly, where the characters start bursting out of my sketchbook.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
So on. But Yeah, but the first part of the book, you know, to get back to your question, is more or less how it really happened. I had done puppets when I was I saw the, you know, I'd seen the Sesame Street and the Muppet Show and so on. But when I saw the Muppet movie, and I, for some reason, seeing those puppets in the real world, you know, just really kind of opened my eyes to the possibilities. And I got gung-ho about puppets for a while. And I was, I think I was about 9 or 10 years old. And we were living in Birmingham because my mom was a newly single parent going back to school. And so we'd moved to Birmingham for the summer so she could, I think she was going to UAB mm-hmm. maybe. And I asked her, she'd been really good about buying me whichever the puppets that were commercially available, you know, Fozzie and Kermit,
right.
Miss Piggy and Animal, my favorite. But they didn't have Gonzo, and I wanted a Gonzo. Even though Animal's my favorite, I still wanted a Gonzo, and I asked her if she would make me a Gonzo. And she's like, I'm in school. She said, I will show you. And it was so much better that she did this. She didn't say no. She said, I will show you how to use the sewing machine.
Oh, cool.
I will show you how to sew. So, you know, again, it goes back to that thing of, you know, give your kid a fish, and they eat one meal, give them a fishing pole, A for life. And I really believe I sort of approach the same thing with my mm-hmm. students. So, you know, that got me into building puppets. So I did puppets for quite a few years. Again, it was great because, you know, you could come up with all these, you know, the crazy characters and situations that I love so much. And then when I got into monsters sometime during high school, and we did a couple of, I don't know how we got away with doing this horror comedy, actually two. No less. We did two horror comedies in my high school. I don't know how they let me get away with it. I'm so grateful they did. I ended up talking to the principal years later. I said, thank you so much for letting me do that. She's like, yeah. She's really sweet. But so we did that, and I was interested in because the play had done so well, about as well as it can do at a, you know, at a small, you know, small town like I grew up in Alabama. Mm-hmm. And because the play did so well, I wanted to be a writer. I was already writing like fantasy and adventure stories. And again, that's sort of, you know, I touch on that in the book. But so so I'd enrolled at Montevallo, which has a fantastic theater department in Alabama, just a marvelous people there. And so I'd already enrolled in that. And so I was going to start in the fall as a theater major. And some friends and I on our you know, it's gonna be our last time together, so we go to the movie mm-hmm. theater. And what do they got playing? It's like Demi Moore and the Seventh Sign. Okay, nothing against Demi Moore, but it was, you know, kind of a not terrific movie. However, and the previews, they showed the opening cartoon from Roger Rabbit as a preview.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so yeah, there's where all this meandering story gets back to your question. How did you get into this animation stuff? You know, well, that's, you know, it's about as brief as I can tell it. So there is Roger Rabbit, which I'm like, man, this is pretty cool. I haven't seen, you know, the animation just moves so smoothly. Yeah. It's not like that Saturday morning stuff I was used to in the 70s. It looked more like the traditional Disney features from the, you know, their heyday, which is exactly what the movie was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, and I can't remember if it was when Roger stepped out of the refrigerator and, you know, all of a sudden they're in a real world. I was just like, you know, but it was somewhere during that preview. I remember thinking exactly, because I quoted this time and again, you know, animation, that's what I want to do for a living. So, you know, that's where I am. And I was fortunately after that, a series of events. I won't, you know, go into all the details, but I was actually able to take an animation class from Richard Williams, who was the animation director on Roger Rabbit. Thank goodness he was just so generous in sharing the information from the classic guys. I mean, what he did was go around and in some cases, he actually lured some of them out of retirement to work at his studio, like guys like Art Babbitt that had worked for Disney and Ken Harris that had done the Coyote for Looney Tunes, and what was the guy? Grim Natwick, the guy that I think invented Betty Boop for Max Fleischer, and he also worked on the Princess and Snow White.
Oh wow!
And so Richard Williams was going around to all these guys before they died, thank goodness, and luring them out of retirement in some cases to come work for him. And thank goodness he put everything in that book. For eventually he put it in the book. The first thing he did was teach the classes live. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness I was able to take the one in, when he was teaching that in San Francisco. And it just, you know, just blows your mind. And he starts off the simple stuff and works his way up into the, you know, what most people think are the sophisticated bits. But, you know, I was just so fortunate that I was able to learn from guys like him. And then, you know, so he did, first he did the live classes, then he did the book, which pretty much became a textbook for so many colleges across the country. And then also, thankfully, he did the DVD series. He recorded the one, I think it was from Blue Sky in New York, and, you know, made that available on DVD. And now the app, that's the real, because, I mean, the DVD set is like $1,000 or $1,200. And, you know, not everybody can afford that. You know, thankfully, I had access to it because, you know, we had it at the library at Art Institute. So I'd show that to my students. And I'm sitting there taking notes, you know. Even though I've took, you know, I was there for the live class, it's a great refresher. And they've got the app now, which is like $35. I tell my students, like, look, if you could either pay $35 for the print copy of the book or pay $35 for the app, which has a PDF of the book and it's got the animated samples that you can scrub through it. So frame by frame, you can see, you know, well, how did he do that? You know, how did he get that perspective in that shot? That's fantastic. And you can see, you know, you can watch it and see frame by frame exactly how he does it, which, oh, it is. It is. I mean, even, I mean, go on, you know, Blu-ray and DVD, but I even go back all the way when VHS was thankfully available when I was, you know, first getting interested in animation. I mean, really, it was like 1986 is where I remember we had our first VCR. But when Roger came out, that's when I started studying animation frame by frame, you know, like watching the old Tex Avery cartoons, which are fantastic. And the, you know, the Disney classics and, you know, just frame by frame. Just, I mean, if you got, that's one of the best ways to study classic animation is just if you got a forward advanced frame controller on your, you know, your player of choice.
Yeah. No, I've always loved animation and Roger Rabbit in particular. I just remember watching that as a kid and just going, just loving it. And the fact that they were able to bring in not just characters from one studio, you know, because bringing in Looney Tunes and Disney into one film is unheard of.
Yeah. And Max Fleischer.
All of those.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if you don't blink, Coco the Clown might be in there somewhere. It's hard to say.
So I know that for the production that you and I worked on for the Owen Security, I equate that to a sort of a Hanna-Barbera style. Do you have a particular, what kind of style of art influenced you to do what you do? Do you have a range of them? Do you like a particular style?
Yeah, it's sort of a mishmash. I mean, people tell me I have a style and I'm like, and that's one of the things that I've read in art schools. That's one of the things that we should discourage students right away. You know, don't try to come up with a style, you know, because what's going to happen is it's going to happen naturally. And you're absolutely right. I've got a lot of influences. I mean, of course, you know, Richard Williams and Roger Rabbit, he just did these spectacular commercials of all things. It's like what he would do, which I thought was rather brilliant, is he would do his commercial business during the day. And the money that he would make on TV commercials, he would use on his, he would, you know, do his personal projects at night, like Thief and the Cobbler, which is good grief. If you ever get it's on YouTube now. It's easy to find it. It's just, I mean, everybody goes on about Roger, which was absolutely terrific. But, you know, Thief and the Cobbler just will blow you away. Any animation that you've ever seen is just so smooth. Because, you know, in animation, Tex Avery is, you know, that zipping around. That's fairly easy to do. But it's like if I want to do something like just pick up this bottle and turn it around like that, that's the hard stuff. You know, when things start moving slowly and subtly, that's the difficult stuff to do in animation. So yeah, it's the sort of thing that I do because, you know, the time and budget constraints that you run into as a commercial artist. You know, we end up doing sort of the Hanna-Barbera approach. And some people belittle Hanna-Barbera. Even I used to, I have to admit, because I used to refer to them as the two anesthesiologists responsible for the comatose state of animation during the 1970s, which was cruel. That was wrong. That was
I
wrong.
I regret that statement.
That was wrong for me to say that. when in fact, you know, looking back on it, you know, once I got a better overview of animation history of the industry, and because, I mean, the really as early as the 1950s, the animation studios shorts started to shut down because television, you know, and so in retrospect, what I now say is they were in fact the two those two were the two doctors that kept animation on life support during the 70s until the, you know, Roger Rabbit. And I always say Roger Rabbit was the one that really boom, that really kicked off the animation renaissance. It had some moments before that when it was really, you know, in the mid 1980s, it was really trying to rev back up, you know, to get life again. The Great Mouse Detective, I think, was a really good one because, you know, not only because of the character animation, the story, and Disney was really getting back into, you know, making you care about the characters actually. But also that it was kind of interesting how that was really the first extensive use they've made of a computer shot, a computer generated shot, a 3D computer generated shot, obviously with that Big Ben sequence, which was, you know, for the time, that's still impressive to me. But they were, so that, you know, Roger in 1988 really kicked off, I think, what we've referred to as the animation renaissance of the 1990s. And then, of course, you know, Little Mermaid right after that. And just, I mean, for a while, it was like Disney could do no wrong, you know, with Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast and Lion King. I mean, they were just, for the first time, they were handing out these massive checks back to the, I mean, these bonus checks to the animators who really deserve, you know, the success. They really should deserve.
I mean, between,
you know,
the Lion King and Aladdin, I mean, those are some, just in my mind, my childhood or growing up, I mean, those are just some of the most key moments of animation, you know?
Oh, yeah, they're spectacular.
Now, of course, now when the new live action, which are still technically kind of animation, comes back out, it hurts my soul a little
bit.
Yeah,
you see the look on my face.
That
one.
just from seeing the beauty of the creation, I distinctly remember sitting in the theater watching the opening scene of Lion King. You know,
yeah,
when all the animals are coming.
I mean, just
the sunrise in the very beginning is
minute or 2 minutes, whatever it is, that whole sequence. It was kind of like Roger. You just take that first 2 minutes, and I mean, you are captivated. You can't wait to see, oh my gosh, what happens next?
Oh my gosh, it's crazy.
It's just absolutely captivating.
Yeah. I love those. You know, I've always loved animation, so it's always fun whenever we can squeeze animation into our work. You know, it's always enjoyable.
Are you listening, clients?
I know, right? So speaking of clients and animation, why do you think animation would help a business sort of stand out from its competition rather than doing a live action?
Well, because so few people want to do it. One of the things that fortunately keeps us in business is like it's so rare that you have a commercial that you can recycle indefinitely, because part of what gets a potential customer, let's call them, or a viewer, what gets their attention is the novelty of something new. So you've always got to keep it fresh. You got to do something different that not everybody else is doing. Before I moved over here, I was making a decent living, about as decent as I could, in Montgomery. And that's part of the reason I moved, is because I realized, you know, this is as far as I can go in this town,
right,
really. Which, you know, it's a beautiful town. There's some wonderful people there and everything. But I was making what I referred to, once again, and I mentioned this in the book, as these boring, recyclable, I mean, just live-action commercials. Are just,
right.
You know, nothing against me, nothing against the people writing the scripts or anything. It's just they'll put you to sleep, you know. Come on down and see the fine folks at, you know, at Blank's House of Blank. We got the finest blank you'll ever blank.
Been in business, you know, for blank years. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, Blank and his wonderful family. And that was one of the things that really made me sick. And you know, I couldn't remember the name of the people if I tried. And, you know, so I was creative services director. And I say creative services director, yeehaw. I was a one-man department, you know, director.
Right.
Whoopee. But it was, I do remember that one incident where it was a car commercial. It was a car dealership. And they were like, you know, they just absolutely insisted on having their darling little children in the last shot of the thing. Because everybody loves kids. I was like, sure. Right. Let's go with that.
The client's always right. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, that is one of the part of, you know, that is one of the things about commercial art is, you know, you do. But, you know, in contrast to that, that's the wonderful thing about animation is you can do anything you want, you know, any crazy concept that you can come up with. You know, in the traditional days of animation, let's say, for instance, you know, even hand drawn, let's say, and I remember reading this somewhere in some book or another about, you know, it's easy to be a writer for animation because you can write anything you want. But then somebody else is, you know, here, I don't know how you're going to do this, but here, good luck. But, you know, say you write a line like, you know, and then you have, 1,000, Arabian warriors coming down, on horseback, waving their scimitars, you know, as they come over the sands of the Sahara or, you know, whatever crazy thing you write, like, sure, that's easy to write that. But then, you know, you got to figure out a way to do that. Well, for instance, right now, on that same thing, how do you get a bunch of duplicate characters in the computer? It's the easiest thing in the world to do. Even Peter Jackson was doing that left and right with, you know, he just records like 10 or 15 guys in armor and then just duplicates them. So, you know, I could do that. I would just have to animate one guy on horseback with his scimitar or whatever you like. And right now I'm working on an animated sequence for the Cartooneyville Fun House show, which I think I mentioned. And so we got this one completely animated sequence within the show, which is based on this character named Gibby the Gibberane that I've been working on with a client. And so we wanted to do a 2-minute fully animated thing. We did like a 60-second PSA for social distance safety with the characters last year, which was great because it got us both, you know, back into gear with the characters. So this we're doing just like a 2-minute fully animated cartoon short. And there's one sequence where a rock gets thrown up against the beehive and all these bees start coming out. Well, you know, if I had animated them by hand, that would be a task indeed. But I really just got to animate two bees.
Right.
I got to animate the queen and I got to animate a worker bee coming out. And then, of course, I can duplicate that like crazy in the computer. I can do in Adobe Animate, which I use, you know, there's, you know, motion paths. So I can just draw a line and then have the, you know, it's going through its little loop and follows that line. And then all his little friends do the same.
Gotcha.
So that's, you know, that's just a really brief thing of how, you know, animation can come in handy like that. And, you know, the Raid commercials, which not a lot of people know, Tex Avery that we mentioned already, he did those. He did those first.
I did not know that.
Those cartoon roaches for Raid. That was Tex Avery. Yeah, he actually did some work in advertising when he got kind of burned out on the, you know, the studio scene, and, you know, the studios were kind of going out of business anyway. I think he did maybe one or two cartoons for Walter Lantz that did Woody Woodpecker. And then he went into advertising, which I thought those, you know, those Raid commercials were just brilliant.
Yeah.
But that's a really good example of, you know, of what you can do with animation in a commercial that you couldn't do in live action. You know, you got to train those roaches.
Yeah, never work with animals, especially roaches.
Yeah, animals and kids. And in animation, they both behave like little angels, you know, or whatever you want them to behave.
So I'm going to assume that you started your career doing hand-drawn animation. And now, obviously, probably much easier, like you were talking about, to do computer animated characters. Do you have a am I wrong, or do you have a preference on which one you like better?
Speak. You're right. When I did, I started off animating on paper. And when I first started out, let me see if I get one of the pencils right here. What I learned really quickly was these blue. See, I've all along the line, I try to search for, you know, shortcuts if it works, and because I was sort of dabbling in comics, drawing comics in the early 90s. I worked very briefly for a short-lived cartoon comic book studio in Montgomery. Wasn't my fault. But they would use the blue pencils, and then they would ink on top of the blue pencils and then scan them in and, you know, color in Photoshop or whatever, even, you know, that far back. But what I learned very quickly was you use the blue pencil So instead of having to like either photocopy or scan or clean up, I would draw with the blue pencils and color erase, which are spectacular. And then I would ink directly on them, and I don't even have to use the eraser really. And just scan them in and I would digitally paint them. But, you know, now with Adobe Animate, ever since the drawing tablets, you know, I've got a fairly small drawing tablet that you don't have to have a big one. And for a while, I even used my little travel one when the big one that I had broke, died, whatever. But, yeah, there was a guy, Jerry Fuchs, another great guy, really nice to me, that worked for Stone Mountain Productions. And we started communicating before I moved over here. And he said, you just watch. He said, you just wait and see. Once you learn how to use Flash, you know, which is now Adobe Animate, he said, once you start to use Flash, you're going to be doing paperless animation before you know it. And I said, like,
you don't know what you're talking about.
And he was right. So I thought what I would probably do is I would do my key drawings, which are, you know, like the poses traditionally, and then I would do all my in-betweening in Flash. But sure enough, he was right, because once I got comfortable with it, essentially what I'll do is and here's just a really quick sample of the sort of storyboards, you know, which is how it all starts off. There's a sneak preview of my next preview for the book. But what I started doing is I'll scan in my storyboards and I'll work on top of those. I'll clean those up. And those are usually my keys, because a key drawing is a storytelling drawing. And then, you know, of course you got the breakdowns and the in-betweens and so on that everybody's always talking about. But with one of the main difference between, say, what most people think of the Disney quality animation is full animation, because it's very seldom that you only move part of a character. Like if I was going to animate this scene right here, I'd really only need to animate, you know, my mouth, which would be on a separate layer, and my hand. And I might not even animate this bit here, you know, so that would be limited animation. But, you know, full animation is all of this, you know, when you have to redraw every single bit when the character's moving. So, you know, and because of the constraints of the budgets and time that I usually work with, it's usually it's a combination of the two that works. You know, you know when to go to limited animation and when to go to full animation. Yeah. And on the Gibby cartoon that I'm working on, there was one point where I had a character who's, you know, he's mm-hmm. fishing. So he's like swinging the reel around like that. And he does uh-huh. that. And it took me almost a day, maybe a day and a half to get that done.
Oh, wow.
You know, just
yeah.
that. But a couple of dialogue shots were, you know, like just me talking, or maybe, you know, talking with my hands a little bit. I can get through like three or four of those in a day, maybe even five or six, depending, as opposed to full animation. It might take me a day to get a whole yeah. shot like that done.
It's a lot of work.
So
that's
kind of the difference.
Yeah. Between,
you know, what we often call limited animation. Some prefer the term stylized,
right.
You know, it sounds a little nicer versus
right.
full animation.
Very cool. So I know you work with both animation and puppets. You have a preference on which one you like more?
Not really. I think it kind of keeps me, fresh and invigorated, kind of going between
sure.
the two. I might get a little, you know, frustrated with how long animation's taking, you know, on some shots. I'm like, I gotta go build a puppet. That's faster. No. So I'll do that for a couple of days, but no, it is kind of nice. And of course, you know, also dabble in stop motion animation. I took a mm-hmm. Class. When I was going to SCAD in grad school, I went to SCAD for a couple of years. And my favorite class there was obviously the stop motion animation class, because, of course, a big fan of, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas
oh, yeah.
and Coraline and films like that are just marvelous films. And so I'm with this new preview that I'm doing for the book that I showed you the storyboards mm-hmm. for. I'm actually going to be mixing stop motion and hand-drawn animation.
Oh, very cool.
But yeah, no, I don't think I'm going to do any puppetry in it. That's about the only thing. And there is, I don't want to give away the ending of the book, but there is I managed to work them sort of all together.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, I like puppetry as well. Yeah. It's been, you know, I've done that longer. I'm just a huge fan of Jim Henson.
And I know you have a puppet with you, right? Did you bring one?
I've got more
oh,
than
did
one.
You?
I'll start off with this one. I'm just so handy that you mentioned that. But yeah, I'll bring this one on. There's a couple of different kinds of puppets, of course. I mean, I'm more of a fan of the, you know, the Sesame Street and Muppet Show style Muppets, and even within them, they've got a couple of different ones. And this is what you call a live arm puppet here. Cool. You see, because I've actually got a hand that I can use. So let me see, you can kind of, this one's kind of like, you can do that too. I mean, this is very low tech, but.
How long did it take you to build this guy?
Oh, let's see. Let me think. 2 or 3 days. Yeah, that's what they usually take. Yeah.
That is awesome. I love it. And does he have a name?
Ask me about my t-shirt. ask me about my t-shirt.
What is the t-shirt you're wearing? I love that shirt. It's a great color.
I am so glad you asked. Yeah, this says a bad day squatching is still better than a good day at the office.
I agree. I couldn't agree more with that statement.
Yeah, so this is – I'm actually going to be having him in a commercial that I wrote for the T-shirts. And in fact, it's kind of funny because that the T-shirt he's wearing, I'm practically dramatizing that as a 30-second commercial where there's like a – there'll be like a guy standing there looking with his binoculars, and then he comes up and tries to talk to him. And of course, the guy doesn't even realize it's a Sasquatch talking to him. That's supposedly he's looking for a Sasquatch.
He's right there talking to him. That'll be
fun. Yeah, and there he is talking to him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's gonna be fun. I think it's one of my my wife was talking about this, and I'm like, she says, "You're gonna make it complicated, are you?" I'm like, "This is about as simple as it gets." So that's what I'm doing. It's, of course, it's on my cartoonyville.com. website. There's a link to both the book and the the t-shirt. So I'm doing I've got at least one t-shirt designed for the that's promoting the book, and then I got several that are cryptid related. I don't know how much you can see of that, but one of the things that we're one of the segments of the Cartoonyville show is actually called Dr. Thylacine's Hall of Cryptids. He is another one of the characters, and that's actually, I'm glad that I mentioned him because he's of the other variety of puppet, which is, as I said, there's sort of two different styles of puppet for the most part, where you've got the live arm or almost like glove hand puppets, like say Fozzie Bear, because he can actually move his hands like the Sasquatch that I just did. And then the other was the rod arm puppets. And that's like, Dr. Thylacine here, because, he's actually got a rod working, much like Kermit the Frog. Yes. Yes. So we've got a lot of, fix my glasses, would you? There's a good fellow. Thank you. Yes. A little better.
I love that.
Yes. Dr. Thylacine's Hall of Cryptids. What is it? Hall of Cryptids.com. Yes, that's the one. Yes. That's another of our many websites that we maintain here through cartoonyville.com and the good graces of our host, or your guest in this case, Professor Mark. Thank you so much.
You must have fun all the time doing this.
Oh, yes, yes. We can hardly shut him up.
That is true.
Yeah, so he's one of the ones I usually went to a lot more trouble on his costume. Now, his costume is actually handmade.
Very cool.
Which took a lot of time. I try not to, that's the cool thing about working with cartoon animals is, nobody cares if they're wearing clothes or not. So that's a great thing because that is one of the things that takes up so much time. But in his case, it was, there's just nowhere else I was going to find it. I got a pattern for his little vest, you see, and the shirt. Of course, I had to modify them because they don't, he likes to eat.
Who doesn't? Especially in COVID.
Apparently. Well, with that, if you don't mind me, I'll be over there. So, yeah. But, the one thing that's really saved me a lot of trouble recently is working on the I'll show you. I wasn't really planning to show you, but I'll go and show you this guy, too, because he's a case of that. What I started doing is working on the scale of Build-A-Bear. Because they have some fantastic costumes already for Build-A-Bear. Let me see if I can get him in here because he's got the,
oh, cool.
Because he's going to be, looking, you know, he's going to be searching for Sasquatch. So I just went ahead and attached those to his nose.
Oh, okay.
You know, so yeah, originally you can't really see much. He was originally, he started off as a Bill Murray caricature. And, but he's just so far off. I don't think I have to worry about Bill Murray suing me. I hope. Yeah, I hope not.
If anything, I feel like Bill Murray would enjoy it.
Oh, I would think so. He seems to have a really good sense of humor. Yeah. Now, here's one. Now, this is where they start to get a little tricky because some of them, you know, with a puppet that has never existed before in any other form, it's okay because, I mean, you can get away with if they don't look like anything they've seen. Because if you look at some of the original sketches of Jim Henson's doodles, say Animal or Uncle Deadly, they don't look a whole lot like what they ended up being. But that was okay because nobody ever saw them. But now some characters that have existed in, say, for instance, 2D, you're sort of obligated to try to make them look. So this guy, it's a sort of a villain that I'm doing.
I like his mustache.
I thought you might. He's also a live action or live arm, I should say, character. Almost finished. Where's my lab coat? You said there was going to be a lab coat.
So he started as a 2D character that you have then
touched. He did. Yeah, he was actually. This is Dr. Gray. He's from the Mocha Girls project, which is there was another one that we did a 2D. I think he needs some mustache moves.
I'll send some over.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, love the stash, bud.
So, he's that's from the Mocha Girls project, which is that's another client, and that's sort of what sort of got into this whole Cartooneyville Funhouse show that I'm putting together. Is I tried, it's one of the things about self-publishing is. There's really two different ways of getting a book published. There's the traditional way, which you write a query letter and try to get a publisher interested in it, and then the parade of rejections begins. You know, usually 6 months before they say, it's not for us. Mm-hmm. No, thank you. Yeah, next. Mm-hmm. But the payoff is better because they cover all the costs of printing, and they handle publicity and marketing and all of that stuff. Self-publishing, or is what it was once called, is now non-traditional publishing, where you pay for the publishing cost, and which is great because you still get editorial services, which I want. You know, I want somebody proofreading my work, even though I proofread like crazy. But I really do like a second pair of eyes. But the only and they can get you listed on like Barnes and Noble and Amazon and so on. Which is great because I wouldn't know how to do any of that. But really, the only downside is they don't do a lot for you as far as publicity, and that's where I've got to kick in the shameless art of self publicity because nobody else is going to do it. So what I did is I made a short film. I started off, I made like a short little ended up being a 3-minute film that I entered in some film festivals and won. Best trailer or something that. I think it was LA Independent Shorts Festival, something like that. I can't remember the exact title of the, I can, try to get that to you. But, and now I'm working on another one, which is like stop motion and animation. But one of the things that came up to the idea for this Cartooneyville Funhouse show is, one of my clients, Bryant from World of Blinky and Friends.com or BlinkyKidsClub.com. He's got two different websites. He said he wanted to do this bit where he had me build one of his puppets, which I don't have Blinky anymore. He's got that one. I gave that to him. He's going to be shooting him on blue screen because Blinky's green. Yeah, that wouldn't work. It'd be like Kermit the Frog on a green screen, but like two ping pong balls. So Blinky would be about, he'd be in the same boat. But now he had this, what I thought was a terrific idea, where he said he was going to have Blinky being interviewed by a reporter about the show. So I thought, now that's interesting. Instead of just an author talking about the work, have your characters talking about the work, which to me is just immediately more interesting. A character talking about the story that they're taking place in, almost like that episode of The Muppet Show where the Star Wars characters pop. One of my favorite episodes easily. But so that's what we're doing. I thought, let's build a whole show around that because I tried contacting like the local papers, who I won't name, in the area. And I didn't get a single response from any of them. I guess like, well, you know, maybe there's just so many authors and illustrators or authors slash illustrators living around. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not really of interest to them. I thought, well, man, I can't even get invited. So I was like, well, dang it. If they're not going to invite me on their talk shows, I'll make my own. So we had done a with Dr. Thylacine last year, we did the Dr. Thylacine's Halloween of Cryptids. Which was a TV special that we did for AIB Network here in Atlanta. And I told them about the idea and they loved it. Thank goodness. Thank you. So they were really supportive, which I really appreciated. And so we're putting the show together. It'll be hopefully soon, you know, broadcasting. I don't want to mention a date yet because that's one of the problems when you're a one-man show. Well, that's not fair to say the one man show because I still got you know John Bonet again doing some wonderful. He's done some marvelous backgrounds for you. I might you know share those with you shortly. And you know Jen Lee's she's already doing some of the voices, and I've got this new stop motion animation crossover that I'm doing this new spot that'll also be that's planned for the show. So I guess that's the idea there is just, you know, a bunch of independents, you know, if the big boys won't do anything to support us, then dang it. The independent artists and creators, let's get together. Let's support each other. You know, let's make this happen.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot of exciting stuff going on.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's a lot of work, but it's fun. Yeah.
So if people watching this want to either see your work or buy a book or get in touch with you to hire you for animation, what's the best way to do that?
The best way to do that is cartooneyville.com. My, contact information's is there. That's also, there's a link to the book. The publisher, it's direct. You can get the book on Amazon. You can get it on, it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. I think Ingram Spark, is that the other one? I think it's on there too. But anyway, you can get all of those to the publisher is listed there on cartooneyville.com. If you like, we can share my Facebook information on the
Absolutely.
Screen too. But yeah, those are good for updates and, you know, little sneak peeks at what I'm working on. And but cartooneyville.com, that's sort of the go-to. And even with cartooneyville.com, that'll still take you to my Facebook page.
Perfect.
For, you know, day-to-day updates on these little wacky little projects with me and my wacky pals, you know.
Well, Professor Mark, I appreciate your time and letting us dive into your world. And I am excited to see what happens.
Well, thank you. I so much appreciate you, Nick. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and patience and listening to all these wacky behind the scenes stuff of animation and puppetry and stop motion animation.
Perfect. Well, sir, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nick.
There now. What seems to be the trouble, Girth?
Well, fellas. Last night, Sasquatch, Deadbeat, and Thurman and me was sitting right here when there was a blinding flash of light. And the next thing we knew, he was in this artist studio. And more cartoon characters kept popping out of his sketchbook. Like space worlds, monsters. And then there was this here really pretty bat lady named Jail. But it turned out to be this crazy platypus critter named Dagger Bill.
Welcome home, Professor.
The Struggling Cartoonist,
an illustrated adventure story available online through cartooneyville.com.